So we're still in 2 Samuel, and last week we finished chapter 12, the incident with David and Bathsheba. And one of the things that occurred to me later, I taught David and Bathsheba a number of times, and as I said, the whole incident sort of reminds me of Clinton and Lewinsky. And I was thinking, if you look at a list of David's sons, and we'll get into Amnon and Tamar today, Amnon was his firstborn son. Solomon is his number 10 born son. So the fact that he's the one that turns up to be his successor, I will suggest probably says something about Bathsheba, just as a point of reference there. So tonight we're going to get into the unfortunate business, or not unfortunate, that's not a great word, a sad business of Amnon and Tamar. One of the things that I started this off with is the Hillsdale College course that I mentioned at the beginning, where the professor there took it from the perspective of failure of fatherhood. David was not a particularly good father, and we'll see that tonight as we see the business with Amnon and Tamar. But the fact is, he's got something like 19 sons, and I don't know how many wives and concubines. I'm not sure we count concubines, but and I'm not sure what a man does with 19 wives. So he's got too much to do. He's trying to consolidate a kingdom. He's trying to do diplomacy. He's trying to run a court. And in that process, it appears that raising children was sort of kind of low on his list. Now, having said that, the rich and powerful have always hired nannies and tutors, and that sort of goes with the territory. And we do need rich and powerful men, but the track record of successors of rich and powerful men is typically not very good. The sons, typically they don't do as well. Part of that, I think, is neglect. They don't have a father paying reasonably close attention to them. You remember the passage in Deuteronomy about a king, and it says that he will not have too many wives. Whatever too many is, isn't specified, but Solomon seems to have stretched it. He had 1,000 women in his stable, and again, I'm not sure what a man does with 1,000. Just don't know. The other part of that, at least in my opinion, is really not fair to the women. Solomon started his marrying campaign for political reasons. His first wife was a daughter of Pharaoh, and so he married her for exactly political reasons. David married his first wife, Michal, for political reasons. He was going to be the son-in-law of the king. Now, they seem to, at least at the beginning, have been genuinely fond of each other, but by the time you get up there more than a couple wives, your attentions get spread pretty thin, and just as it is not good for a man to be alone, it is not good for a woman to be alone. So what you wind up with is a lot of alone time on the part of the gals in the stable, and what they do is they get into mischief. Perfectly normal, perfectly human, and you wind up with all sorts of problems in the court and everything else. And so what we're going to see here with Amnon and Tamar is David's family was sort of running itself. And that, I think, is not good. So 2 Samuel 13. Now Absalom, David's son, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And after a time, Amnon, David's son, loved her. So Amnon is number one born. Absalom is number three. So you have Amnon first, then Daniel, then Absalom, and then Adonijah. Amnon, Absalom, Adonijah, and Solomon are the only ones that we really hear much about, other than just being named. So Amnon is the firstborn, and he's in lust for his half-sister. Now, we've all read the Torah, and one of the things that is expressly forbidden is sexual fooling around between sister and brother, regardless of whether they're half-sister and half-brother. It says specifically, whether she is your full sister or the daughter of one of your father's other wives. In either case, she's forbidden according to the Torah. Now, I understand that lust has its own logic, and the fact that Amnon is smitten with this girl is chemical, but it's forbidden for several reasons. Verse 2, and Amnon was so tormented that he made himself ill because of his sister Tamar, for she was a virgin, and it seemed impossible to Amnon to do anything to her. And yes, it should have been. But Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother. And Jonadab was a very crafty man. Now, we're going to hear of Jonadab again. He is a troublemaker. I don't know what the relationship was between David and his brothers, because you remember, David is the last son of his father. And when Samuel goes to his father's house and says, all right, I want to anoint one of your sons king, he trots out the sons in order, and Samuel says, nope, not that one, nope, not that one, nope, not that one. And they're all good-looking, strong young men. And we finally go out and get the youngest one that they don't even bother to bring into the house. And he's the one that's chosen. And when David goes to fight with Goliath, his brothers chew him out. You know, what are you doing here, little brother? Did you just come to watch the battle kind of thing? So I don't know what the relationship is between David's brothers and himself. So I don't know where Jonadab got his attitude. It may simply be that he's a sly and crafty guy, or it may have been that there was some bad-mouthing, if you will, in David's family from his brothers. I just don't know the answer to that. But he has access to the court, obviously, and he is crafty and devious. Verse 4, and he said to him, oh, son of the king, why are you so haggard morning after morning? Will you not tell me? Amnon said to him, I love Tamar, Absalom's sister. Jonadab said to him, lie down on your bed and pretend to be ill. And when your father comes to see you, say to him, let my sister Tamar come and give me bread to eat and prepare the food for my sight, that I may see it and eat it from her hand. Now, I've got no idea why this works. All right, you're David. You've got a flock of wives and so forth. And one of your sons is saying, oh, I'm just terribly ill. Would you send Tamar in here to make food for me? I just don't understand why David doesn't see right through that. Verse 6. So Amnon lay down and pretended to be ill. And when the king came to see him, Amnon said to the king, please let my sister Tamar come and make a couple of cakes in my sight, that I may eat from her hand. Then David sent home to Tamar, saying, go to your brother Amnon's house and prepare food for him. The only thing I can think in all of this is Amnon and Tamar may have been close childhood playmates kind of thing. You know, they're all part of David's family, and it may have been the case that the two of them hung around together growing up. I just don't know. But that's the only thing I can see might be a reason why this would play out that way. So David said to Tamar, go to your brother Amnon's house and prepare food for him. So Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house, where he was lying down, and she took dough and kneaded it and made cakes in his sight and baked the cakes. And she took the pan and emptied it out before him, but he refused to eat. And Amnon said, send out everyone from me. So everyone went out from him. Then Amnon said to Tamar, bring the food into the chamber that I may eat from your hand. I mean, this just is getting weirder and weirder. And Tamar took the cake she had made and brought them into the chamber to Amnon, her brother. I have no idea why alarm bells aren't going off in several heads here. First David's and then Tamar's, the same thing. Come on into the bedroom and feed me would have been a pretty obvious invitation for something to happen. Verse 11, but when she brought them near to him to eat, he took hold of her and said to her, come lie with me, my sister, She answered him, "No, my brother, do not violate me, for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this outrageous thing. As for me, where could I carry my shame? And as for you, you would be as one of the outrageous fools in Israel. Now therefore, please speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you." That feels like if we did this right, she would be okay with it. At least that's the way it sounds. The other possibility, of course, is she's just trying to put him off and get out of there. Not obvious from the text, it could be either way. Verse 14, "But he would not listen to her, and being stronger than she, he violated her and lay with her. Then Amnon hated her with a very great hatred, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. And Amnon said to her, 'Get up, go.' But she said to him, 'No, my brother, for this wrong in sending me away is greater than the other that you did to me.' But he would not listen to her. He called the young men who served him and said, 'Put this woman out of my presence,' and bolt the door after her." Obviously, Amnon is a jerk and a lout. I got no idea what's going through his head, but once the act is finished, his lust is sated, and he realizes how stupid this is or whatever. I just don't know. But clearly not a considerate guy, to say the least. Verse 18, "Now she was wearing a long robe with sleeves, for thus were the virgin daughters of the king dressed. So his servant put her out and bolted the door after her. And Tamar put ashes on her head and tore the long robe that she wore, and she laid her hand on her head and went away crying aloud as she went. And her brother Absalom said to her, 'Has Amnon your brother been with you? Now hold your peace, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this to heart.' So Tamar lived a desolate woman in her brother Absalom's house. When King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. But Absalom spoke to Amnon neither good or bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had violated his sister Tamar." Several things here. David may have been very angry, but it doesn't say that he did anything. That's sort of thing one. You all remember that in Leviticus that we just read this week, it says, "You shall not hate your neighbor in your heart, and you shall not bear a grudge." What we're going to see is what happens when you do. Absalom does not say a word to his brother. It's going to be 2 years. And after a while, Amnon is going to forget about the whole thing, think it's all blown over. That is not the case. Absalom is not satisfied. And the reason it says that you will not hate your neighbor in your heart is because of that. If you keep the grudge inside of you, your neighbor goes along and doesn't realize how much you hate him. Not on guard, just doing whatever neighbors do. Until some point you rise up and do him some damage. You may kill him, or you may simply do him damage or something like that. This is the reason for that particular commandment. And Rabbi Foreman had an excellent teaching on it. What Foreman says is, okay, what Absalom should do is go to Amnon and say, "You," whatever long nasty words you have in Hebrew to explain just what you think of the guy, and say, "I don't ever want to see you again, and if you do, I'll kill you." Okay, now, at this point, it's all out in the open. Everybody knows what's going on. We're enemies. And everybody in the Bible who is anybody has enemies. So Amnon isn't going along unguarded and uncaring, thinking everything's all right until you ambush him, which is what's going to happen here. Amnon is aware that we got a problem here, and he can behave accordingly around you. Verse 23, "After 2 full years, Absalom had sheep shears at Baal-hazor, which was near Ephraim. And Absalom invited all the king's sons. And Absalom came to the king and said, 'Behold, your servant has sheep shearers. Please let the king and his servants go with your servant.' But the king said to Absalom, 'No, my son, let us not all go, lest we be burdensome to you.'" Now, you remember the incident with Nabal and Abigail. When David was down in the south of Judea, and he was acting as an enforcer around the area, when Nabal was doing a sheep shearing, it was a big celebration, because this is when all of the hard work tending the sheep all year pays off. We get them and we shear them, and now we've got all this wool that we can either use or sell. So the same thing that happens in the book of Ruth, when Boaz and his men are harvesting. The harvest is a big festival. You got hard work to do to get all the grain in, but at the end of it, Boaz's heart was merry because he had been drinking. It was a big party. The same thing happens at a sheep shearing. So what Absalom is doing is inviting all of his brothers to this big party that we're going to have. David said, party that size is going to be expensive. Don't need them all there. 25 again. But the king said to Absalom, "No, my son, let us not go, lest we be burdensome to you." He pressed him, but he would not give him his blessing. Then Absalom said, "If not, please let my brother Amnon go with us." And the king said to him, "Why should he go with you?" Again, the cluelessness of all this is just breathtaking. But Absalom pressed him until he let Amnon and all the king's son go with him. Then Absalom commanded his servants, "Mark when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say to you, strike Amnon, then kill him. Do not fear, have I not commanded you? Be courageous and be valiant." So the servants of Absalom did to Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose and each mounted his mule and fled. Now, his heart was merry. It's obvious that in sheep shearing, it was a party. And after all the hard work of getting the wool in, they were having a party. The other thing that's interesting here is all the rest of the king's sons mounted up on the mules and got out of there. I will suggest the reason for that is they aren't sure how far this fratricide is going to go. On the surface, if you don't remember the incident with Tamar, it looks like number three son has taken out number one son in order to get himself set to be the king. One of the things that happens in royal courts like this is when one son ascends to the throne, he very often gets rid of the rest of them. So obviously two reasons they fled. One is, oh my gosh, what did you just do? And we need to get out of here. But the other is probably a fairly healthy fear that they might be next. 30. While they were on the way, news came to David. Absalom has struck down all the king's sons, and not one of them is left. So the word gets back that Absalom's his only son. Then the king arose and tore his garments and lay on the earth, and all his servants who were standing by tore their garments. But Jonadab, here we go again, but Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, said, "Let not my lord suppose that they have killed all the young men, the king's son, for Amnon alone is dead. For by the command of Absalom, this has been determined from the day he violated his sister Tamar. Now therefore, let not my lord the king take it to heart as to suppose that all the king's sons are dead, for Amnon alone is dead." Now, how does Jonadab know this? Because all of the king's sons mounted up on their mules and are headed back to Jerusalem. So unless he's got the fastest mule, which is possible, he appears to know what's going to happen. Just like he set up Amnon with Tamar, he may well have been privy to what Absalom was going to do to Amnon. As it said at the beginning when they described this guy, he was a crafty man. Who was the guy in Lord of the Rings, Wormtongue? Anyway, you have this guy Wormtongue, who was the king's close advisor. And Wormtongue is a really good name for him because he's always stirring the pot and causing trouble and so forth. That's who Jonadab is. He's like Wormtongue. He's always where something is going on, and he's always causing trouble. 34. But Absalom fled, and the young man who kept the watch lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, many people were coming from the road behind him by the side of the mountain. And Jonadab said to the king, "Behold, the king's sons have come, as your servant said. So it has come about." So unless Jonadab had a seriously fast mule and got there ahead of time and got in to see the king and so forth, it appears that he was in on it ahead of time. 36. And as soon as he had finished speaking, behold, the king's son came and lifted up their voices and wept. And the king also and all his servants wept very bitterly. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Ammihud, king of Geshur. Talmai is his grandfather. The mother of Absalom is the daughter of Talmai. So when Absalom flees to Geshur, Talmai, he is going to his grandfather. And David mourned for his son day after day. Also Absalom fled and went to Geshur and was there 3 years. And the spirit of the king longed to go out to Absalom because he was comforted about Amnon since he was dead. So once he gets done mourning for Amnon, then he wants Absalom back. Now, Absalom is going to turn out to be a power-hungry young man. He's going to be the one that runs David out of Jerusalem. And of course, you all know that in that incident, Joab is going to kill Absalom. And David is going to mourn more for Absalom than he does for his own kingdom. And Joab is going to jerk him up and say, you got to knock this stuff off. So apparently, David really liked Absalom. And once he gets over the fact that he took revenge on his brother, he wants Absalom back. Chapter 14. Now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, knew that the king's heart went out to Absalom. And Joab sent to Tekoa and brought from there a wise woman and said to her, pretend to be a mourner and put on mourning garments. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but behave like a woman who has been mourning many days for the dead. Go to the king and speak thus to him. So Joab put the words in her mouth. When the woman of Tekoa came to the king, she fell on her face to the ground and paid homage and said, save me, O king. Now, I'm not sure how this random woman gets in to see the king. She may not be a random woman. She may be somebody who's known and has access. I just don't know. It just describes her as a wise woman. And the fact that Joab chose her indicates that she may indeed have been known. But the fact is, she goes into the king. Verse 5. And the king said to her, what is your trouble? She answered, alas, I am a widow. My husband is dead, and your servant had 2 sons. And they quarreled with one another in the field. There was no one to separate them, and the one struck the other and killed him. Now the whole clan has risen against your servant, and they say, give up the man who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed. So they would destroy the heir also. Thus they would quench my coal that is left and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth. Obviously what's going on is the local townspeople have said this is not manslaughter, it's murder. Because remember, when you have a death like that, it gets investigated. And if it's manslaughter, which is to say there was no intent to kill and you weren't enemies before, but it's just one of those things, then you go to the city of refuge and all of that. And of course, the mother, as she says here, said, I've only got 2 sons. So having lost one, I don't want to lose the other, both for inheritance reasons and for practical reasons, in that I am now a widow with no support. She doesn't say that, but that would obviously be one of her considerations. Verse 8. Then the king said to the woman, go to your house, and I will give orders concerning you. And the woman of Tekoa said to the king, on me be the guilt, my lord the king, and on my father's house, let the king and his throne be guiltless. What she's saying here is, if you circumvent justice, we'll assume for the moment that the elders of the town have done right, and they've determined that it was murder, and this young man needs to be put to death. Let's assume that's correct. If the king goes in and changes that, what she's saying is, let the guilt for that be on me and my house and not on the king. She's saying that we'll bear the spiritual ramifications of a decision like that. It won't fall on you. Now, having said that, there are two judicial functions. You've got a judge and you've got a king. It is the job of a judge to simply look at the case, determine the facts, apply the law, and make a decision. That theoretically is the job of a judge. Now, judges being human will vary from that, and some of our judges go way beyond that, but that's technically the job of a judge. So a judge says, this is what happened, looks to me like murder, guilty. A king is the one who can give mercy. In our system, for example, what you have is, theoretically, a judge is supposed to look at somebody and say, you did X, Y, and Z, the law says this, therefore you're guilty and you're going to be executed, go to prison, whatever. It is possible then for the executive, the president or the governor, to exercise clemency and to say, yes, I know he's guilty. I understood what you said, judge. However, I am giving him clemency. That's the function of a king or an executive. So David, in this case, is perfectly within his legal and spiritual rights to commute this guy's death sentence. Nothing wrong with that at all. And what David would say is, yeah, I know he's guilty of murder, but his father would then have no heir, there would be no inheritance, and his mother, a widow, would be a real problem, so I'm going to grant him clemency and let him take care of his mother, and perhaps get married and have children. Verse 10, the king said, if anyone says anything to you, bring him to me, and he shall never touch you again. Then she said, please let the king invoke the Lord your God, that the avenger of blood kill no more, and my son be not destroyed. He said, as the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. I'm not sure who the avenger of blood is in the case where you have two brothers. Technically, the avenger of blood is the nearest male relative. Fratricide, I got no idea how that works. Verse 12. Then the woman said, please, let your servant speak a word to my lord the king. And he said, speak. And the woman said, why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in giving this decision, the king convicts himself, as much as the king does not bring his banished one home again. What she obviously is saying here is, okay, I have just set up this situation. You have exercised clemency. Why are you not doing the same thing for your own son? That's the question. Verse 14, we must all die. We are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. But God will not take away life, and he devises means so that the banished one will not remain an outcast. Now I have come to say this to my lord the king, because the people have made me afraid, and your servant thought, I will speak to the king. It may be that the king will perform the request of his servant. For the king will hear and deliver his servant from the hand of the man who would destroy me and my son, together with the heritage of God. And your servant thought, the word of my lord the king will set me at rest. For my lord the king is like the angel of God, discerning good and evil. The Lord your God be with you. So made this speech saying, I knew you were going to give me a good answer. You did. And, oh, by the way, why aren't you doing this for your own son? Verse 18. Then the king answered the woman, do not hide from me anything I ask you. And the woman said, let my lord the king speak. And the king said, is the hand of Joab with you in all this? The woman answered and said, as surely as you live, my lord the king, one cannot turn to the right hand or the left from anything my lord the king has said. It was your servant Joab who commanded me. It was he who put all these words in the mouth of your servant. So Joab, as we have seen over and over again, is a crafty guy. And he also is someone who desires to be very close to power. Now, he didn't do this himself. And I suspect the reason he didn't do that is because David would have been on his guard. You remember the incident of Bathsheba? Nathan doesn't come right into the king and say, you adulterer, you murderer. He doesn't say that. What he does is he spins a story about a sheep. And this person that has this one sheep, and this rich man steals it. And what he does is he builds up this story until David is saying, in righteous indignation, that man should be put to death. And at that point, Nathan springs on him, you are the man. Joab has done the same thing here. He has set up this woman to come in and spin this elaborate tale about one brother killing another, and he's the last one, and he's the only thing standing between me and poverty. He's the only possibility of an inheritance for my husband, and so forth and so forth. And David says, right, he should be spared. And then she springs on him, well, why don't you spare your own son then, if that's the case? So very much the same thing that happened with Nathan has happened here. And Joab engineered. Whereas if Joab had come and done that himself, David would have been on his guard. Maybe Joab isn't a good storyteller, or maybe he's been talking to David, when are you going to get your son back, or you know, anything. But he sets up this charade so that his hand is in it until it actually gets sprung. And then David said, did Joab do this? Yeah, he did. 19 and a half. It was your servant Joab who commanded me. It was he who put all these words in the mouth of your servant. In order to change the course of things, your servant Joab did this. But my Lord has wisdom like the wisdom of the angel of God, to know all things that are on the earth. Yeah, he set me up, but it's a good decision. You ought to do it. 21. Then the king said to Joab, behold now, I grant this. Go bring back the young man Absalom. And Joab fell on his face to the ground and paid homage and blessed the king. And Joab said, today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, my lord the king, in that the king has granted the request of your servant. So Joab arose and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. And the king said, let him dwell apart in his own house. He is not to come into my presence. So Absalom lived apart in his own house and did not come into the king's presence. So David still has no idea what to do with this young man, but he's brought him home at least. 24. Now in all Israel, there was no one so much to be praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish on him. And as he cut the hair of his head, for at the end of every year, he used to cut it when it was heavy on him, he cut it. He weighed the hair of his head 200 shekels by the king's weight. That's 5 pounds. 27. There were born to Absalom 3 sons and 1 daughter whose name was Tamar. So he named his daughter after his sister. She was a beautiful woman. So Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem without coming into the king's presence. Then Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king, but Joab would not come to him. And he sent a second time, but he would not come. Then he said to his servants, see, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go set it on fire. So Absalom's servants set the field on fire. And Joab arose and went to Absalom at his house and said to him, why have your servants set my field on fire? Absalom answered Joab, behold, I sent word to you. Come here that I may send you to the king to ask, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to be there still. Now, understand that he is the grandson of the king of Geshur. So living in Geshur, he lives a normal life with his grandfather. Coming back to Jerusalem, he's in David's household, but David's not paying any attention to him. So his thing is, heck, I had it better with my granddad. Why'd you call me back? So again, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to be there still. Now therefore, let me go to the presence of the king. And if there is guilt in me, let him put me to death. Then Joab went to the king and told him. And he summoned Absalom. So he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king. And the king kissed Absalom. So we have sort of reconciliation. We're going to stop there for tonight. Because the next thing that's going to happen is Absalom is going to run David out of town and try and have him killed. So based on his behavior with his brother Amnon, based on his behavior with his father the king, this is clearly a guy that plots things in his heart with the intention of springing them later. So the fact that he's been called back to his father and his father kisses him does not mean that Absalom is in any way reconciled. I think, and this is just a guess, that Absalom needs to be in the court to do what he wants to do next, which is he's going to gather a retinue of his own, and he's going to gather influence on his own, and I think he needs access to be able to do that. What he's going to do is he's going to set up outside the gate, and he's going to talk to people who are coming in that have a grievance and say, boy, if I were the king, I would settle this for you. As it will say in Scripture, he will steal the hearts of people away, and they will start looking at him as the heir and the king, so that when he finally does go against his father, there will be a large contingent following him. He needs to have his father's blessing to do that. David isn't talking to him. Yeah, he's here, but he's on the outs. He will have a hard time doing that. So I suspect that one of the things that's going on here, where they make this big reconciliation, is he is already planning what he's going to do and needs to be in the court in order to pull it off. Scripture doesn't say that, but I suspect that's what's going on. We have, in all cases here, a young man who holds his counsel, and you don't ever know what he's planning until he springs the trap. And as I said earlier, that is the very antithesis of do not hate your neighbor in your heart. God says don't do that, because you wind up with stuff like this. The other thing I did want to mention, one of the things that God said to David after the incident with Bathsheba, he said, you're going to have trouble in your own family. And he says, someone is going to take your wives and lay with them openly so everybody can see it. This is the beginning of that. All of David's troubles from now on come from within his own family. We have this incident with Amnon, where Amnon rapes his sister. I mean, that's really bad. Then we have the murder of Amnon. Then we're going to have Absalom trying to take him out. Then we're going to have Adonijah is going to try and take him out. He isn't going to get as far as Absalom did. But the point is, David's family is a mess.